essences of the Judaism and Christianity, but I was wondering how he missed the concept of substitutionary sacrifice.
I don't think he did. I think it's a misreading of the Quran. Through again, when Muslims broke away, they lost some things too. But the Quran has the concept of the great sacrifice. When we do the sacrifice, it's really only a symbol of the great sacrifice. They don't know what that is. But it's there. Yeah, the Quran is a surprising book. And the gap between it and the New Testament is not nearly as great as both Christians and Jews think. But it's sometimes it's just a matter of reading the material with a mind that is willing to be open and not reading the material with an assumption of looking for what's bad. You know, see, if you sat down and read the Quran and just, you know, looking for the more positive side, you wouldn't find nearly as much as you'd expect. And it's not nearly as violent a book as Revelation, for example. So there's a lot of misunderstandings, I think, out there. Yeah. Yes? Well, in the Quran, and again, this is not how most Muslims would read it, but in the Quran, there are some strong hints of a greatness for Jesus that transcends even Muhammad. I think you can go there in the Quran. Here's the interesting thing. The Quran is a very ambiguous book. And as a result, whoever reads it tends to read it with some outside reference in mind. Most Sunni Muslims read the Quran with the hadith in mind, which are the traditions of what Muhammad said and did that were put together after his life. Just remembrances of him, kind of like the testimonies of Ellen White or something like that. Other Muslims read the Quran with reference to the scholars of the Middle Ages. And other Muslims read the Quran through the eyes of the Wahhabis, like the last 200-300 years in Saudi Arabia, which have a very different perspective as well. The Quran itself says, as you've seen, you want to understand this, go back to the Bible. Muslims haven't done that. And I've found that when you read the Quran in the light of the New Testament, it becomes a very different book. The Quran is not complete and it's not clear. No, that's absolutely not where we need to go, because the greatness of Jesus is without question. And again, I think there's a scholar out there, his name is Mark Siljander, who wrote a book called A Deadly Misunderstanding. That would be profitable reading for anybody. He sees the Aramaic language as a bridge between the New Testament and the Arabic of the Quran. And I was skeptical when I started reading the book. And as I went through, I just thought, whoa. You know, when you read through the original languages, you discover a lot of things we thought were clear are not nearly so clear. And the Quran is not nearly so negative about Jesus and about the Trinity and some of these things as we had thought. It is criticizing, how should we put it, apostate Christianity and Judaism in Arabia at that time. And you compare what Muhammad did with what was there before, it was a reform. I'm not saying he's inspired or anything. That's he himself wasn't sure on that a lot of the time. But I think there's no question that God used him to restore a lot of things that had been lost. So I think if you take a negative approach to Islam, you can find plenty to pick about, but they can find some things with us too. So I would encourage us to try to see others at their best and to see that sometimes God has not forsaken people who we would write off. That's kind of the eschatological message I see in the Old Testament. People that we would have written off, like the Egyptians and the Assyrians, God didn't write them off. And they were brutal. They were nasty people, yeah, especially the Assyrians, yeah.
With 9/11 and the war on terror and great hostility,
I don't know how much that does, except that I think a lot of us had never really looked at Islam before, and September 11 suddenly helped a lot of people realize you can't ignore this one way or another. And I think a lot of people began to study and began talking to people. And one of the recent developments is the General Conference was invited to send a few people to talk to some Islamic scholars in another part of the world and to sit down and study eschatology together. And when those studies were done, the Muslims said, everything that you have said here is what we believe. But there's a difference. The difference is when you say it, it's much more organized and makes a lot more sense. For us, it's just kind of scattered and fragmented. Like I said, the Quran is just kind of scattered. It by itself, it's not complete. And what they asked, would you be willing to have these papers go into a book that we would publish and scatter around the Islamic world? And our people responded in good old Adventist fashion, well, we better go back and check with the people who sent us first. Yeah, but I think that it will happen. And I that will be an awesome thing if it happens, because a book co-published by Adventist and Muslim scholars would first of all give every Muslim permission to talk to Adventists about these things. And it would give every Adventist something to take to their Muslim friends and say, we can talk about this. So it would open up a whole new world. Whether that'll happen or not, we'll see.
I think there's danger, because the Muslim end of that, those folk are going to be isolated by the radicals who seem to be pushing another agenda.
There's no question that there's a war within Islam. Osama bin Laden's target was not the United States. His target was Islam itself, and attempting this Wahhabi version of Islam would become transcendent. The vast majority of Muslims aren't buying it, but they've struggled to find their voice. It's one thing to say what you believe in a free country and when there's no consequences, not even your job. It's another thing to say it when you may be gunned down on your way out. I think we have to understand that that's a tough situation there. Let me just make a comment. All right, I think as Adventists, one of the characteristics we have is a tremendous fear of ecumenism. And it's a good fear. It is a just fear. Ecumenism, as we define it, is religious institutions uniting together for political purpose and common advantage. That, historically, is always a disaster. It never leads us to a positive place. On the other hand, there's another form, call it ecumenism or what you will, there's another that is absolutely essential to the preaching of the gospel. And that is going out there and talking to people and finding kindred spirits out there. If you'll talk to a dozen Muslims, you'll find kindred spirits. There may be some radicals out there, but most Muslims are more open to spiritual conversation than most Christians are. That's simply my experience. If you can avoid the arguments, and see, and that's the problem. The minute we get into Trinity, the minute we get into that kind of stuff, there's a war, and everybody feels good about it. Boy, we told them, no, nothing changes. But every Muslim has a strong spiritual need. It's a very spiritual religion. And my process has been, if a Muslim wants to talk about the Trinity and Jesus, I say, you know, that's an interesting question. It'll be fun to talk about that sometime, but right now I'm interested in something else. What's that? Says, let me ask you a question. What does prayer mean to you? I want to know. First of all, they're shocked, half out of their wits, that you'd be interested or even think a Muslim would have anything to say about prayer. Second of all, they'll be all excited to share with you what prayer means to them. And they're very hospitable people. And the next step will be, okay, what does prayer mean to you? And then they may be shocked to discover that you know as much or more about prayer than they do. And suddenly a spiritual relationship is born. Now you say, is that dangerous? Well, it could be if you have no idea where you're going or what you're doing. But if you are united to Jesus Christ and he's given you a passion for souls, that could be one of the most exciting things that ever happened. Bill Johnson, if I hope this probably shouldn't be on tape, but Bill Johnson is a new man since these conversations. He had no idea that Muslims were such passionately spiritual people, so interested in the Bible and in so many other things. And in the conversation, how open and interested they were in even modifying their views in the light of fresh evidence from writings that they understood to be inspired. So I would say this, if you're scared to death of Muslims, if you think that they're the curse of the earth, make one friend first before making up your mind. People who are really, really down on Muslims usually don't have any Muslim friends. They're just reading the papers and reading the internet. And you can be scared of Adventists doing that. There's been an Adventist revolutionary army. I won't tell you the country, but there's a country where there was an Adventist army. They wouldn't fight on Sabbath, and then they'd, you know, burn down a government outpost on Sunday. And these things can happen. David Koresh could probably be considered an Adventist terrorist in many ways. Well, we kind of dumped him at one point. I don't think he ever dumped us. If you've ever seen movies, documentaries about it, to hear him talking and stuff, he sounds like an Adventist. We watched that with our kids when they were small, and they were freaked out. They couldn't sleep that night because these Davidian kids sounded so Adventist. I said, "What is the government going to come and get us now?" You know. So we decided that documentary was much more scary than monsters. Yeah. Okay. There was a hand over here. Here. I think our biggest barrier is pride. And a very spiritual person can still be a proud person. It's a very subtle, a very sneaky thing. And it's a battle I fight every day. Just ask my wife, you know. The quick reactions we make, even in a marriage, it shows that, you know, it's not dead. And corporately, there is such a thing as pride. You know, just that subtle sense that we have all the answers and other people do not. You know, and one thing. Let me just share with you a perspective. You know, I got some of this. Maybe probably even sounds dangerous. Well, take it for what it's worth. But I've asked myself the question: if God is the one who removes kings and sets up kings, then what is he doing allowing the Catholic Church to win for 1,000 years? Well, what's up with that? What role did that play? And suddenly it dawned on me, because the Catholic Church got the most important thing right. And what is that? The canon of Scripture. If you had gone with any of these other five branches of Christianity, the Bible would be a very different book than it is today. Very different. Marcion, he wanted just 10 letters of Paul and part of the Gospel of Luke. That would have been the total canon. Montanus, canon would have been hundreds of books. Would have been very charismatic, you know, Pentecostal and so on. You go down through the list. Ebionites, they would have rejected Paul for sure. You see? So to get the canon that we have today required the winner who won. And if you get the canon right, everything else is fixable. So you see, they didn't have everything right, but they got the one thing right. That makes me wonder, what is the one thing that Adventists have right? Are we flawless now compared to all these others? No. We have a mission. It is, I think, core to the time in which we live. But the idea that we have everything right and everything together, history would not support that. All right, so just this is the pride thing, okay? I'm going right at your question, maybe a roundabout. I think there's a danger in the idea that if Adventists can get themselves together, then everything will work out. You see, and ultimately it's God who works things out rather than us. We're only his servants. And revival and reformation might cause us to have a lower opinion of ourselves spiritually. The closer we get to Jesus, the more clearly we see the defects in other people's characters. Isn't that what Steps to Christ says? You remember what she said. A revival and reformation might cause us to have a lower opinion of ourselves in God's plan. Someone who hasn't spoken yet, and then we can come back to some others. Yeah. Davidians, okay, yeah. Yeah. Did they survive? Because they were at school. That's good. Yeah. Schools are relatively safe places these days. I think there's a handout here. You mean Fournier or Fiorenza? Fiorenza's the one who had a structure very similar to mine. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Well, there are a number of other Adventists who have come up with versions of that and or have endorsed the one that I've done. There's been a couple of other scholars that have something somewhat similar. Yeah. Oh, Jeremias, yeah, okay. Jesus didn't speak Greek. Well, he may have spoken Greek, but generally when he was in talking, you know, in Judea and stuff like that, he was talking Aramaic, most likely the language. Hebrew at that time was kind of forgotten. Only the priests really used that. So Aramaic was likely the language. And there was a scholar named Jeremias who took the sayings of Jesus in Matthew, translated them back into Aramaic, and discovered rhymes, rhythms, word plays, jokes, riddles that are missing in the Greek. So very, very, Jesus used a very lyrical kind of language, easy to remember. You know, jingles are easy to remember. Mary had a little lamb, you know, fleece was white as snow. Jesus used a lot of that stuff. And even jokes, you know, even humorous expressions. You catch a few of them. You know, Jesus says, if you see the beam, you know, if you see the splinter in your brother's eye, he says, you got to get the beam out of your eye before you can deal with that. You know, you could just see somebody, you know, kind of like you're trying to see the splinter in someone else's eye. You know, that's funny. So anyway, yeah. Did you want me to say any more about that? Yeah. Yeah, the New Testament as we have it is written in Greek, which is a translation of the words of Jesus. And in the translation process, some of the poetry is lost, is I think pretty clear. Yeah. Yes. The internet is a wonderful possibility, and we probably have only begun to explore the options there. And by the way, if you're interested, my theological website is thebattleofarmageddon.com. Just one word, thebattleofarmageddon.com. And there's a blog there, and there's a bunch of articles and different things there. If that interests you, we don't mind people visiting. Thus far, it hasn't become world-renowned or anything, but there's some stuff there if you're interested. Yeah, I think the internet has all kinds of possibilities we haven't fully explored. The one problem from an institutional perspective is it tends to, for people to connect apart from the usual types of connection, like being in a church together and so on. People tend to be more private about the beliefs that they come up with on the internet. And they tend to be more syncretistic. They, you know, pick something here, pick something there, and end up with a mishmash that no one would recognize. But yeah, I think there's tremendous potential. God, as I said, meets people where they are. He'll use stuff like that. All right, we got about 5 minutes left. I'll take some people who have already spoken as well. Yeah. Okay, well, that's not a simple question. That's not a simple answer, and I probably, anything I would say in less than 2 minutes would do more harm than good, most likely. What would I say in 2 minutes or less? It's just simply that it's a lot more complicated than most people make it. There's a simple answer on each side. Neither of those are really satisfactory. Maybe I should just leave it there. Don't just go with the first thing you hear and think you solved the problem. It's not quite that simple. The Bible. Let me say this and then stop on that. All right. Biblically speaking, the case for a short age creation is way stronger than any other options. I know there's people trying to pick through and come up with other stuff, but that's way stronger than any other option. So if the Bible's going to be central to your faith, you're going to end up with a short age type of creation scenario. So I think that's pretty plain, at least to most scholars. Philosophically, it's kind of 50-50. Design is certainly a very strong argument philosophically, very persuasive. But there's also some strong arguments from the point of evil and predation and so on that are very, very troubling. So it's kind of, if you get into the philosophy, you kind of get beaten back and forth. Scientifically, the evidence for a long age evolution of stuff is way, way stronger. I think all Adventist scientists would agree on that. They wouldn't agree on what to do with that information necessarily. But creationists have a way of trivializing the evidence sometimes and making it seem all cut and dried. It's not. It's very, very tough, and it's tougher than it's ever been. If you read the creationist books of 40 years ago, none of those arguments work anymore. So clearly we're struggling scientifically. So ultimately the issue is, what do you do when the Bible takes you here and the evidence of your eyes, your ears take you here? And I think I go with the Bible. Yeah, that's my standpoint. However, when you're going to stand in a class and teach science, you've got to teach science that works. You've got to teach science that prepares people for the laboratory, for graduate school, and things like that. And that means that the science that will be taught in an Adventist college may not be the science that the typical member would wish that could be taught. So it's a tough. What I'm asking for here is sympathy for Adventist scientists. It's not an easy task that we're throwing at them. We're asking them to believe this, but also faithfully teach this and help the students to wrestle with the disjunct between those two. And that's not easy to do. So I have a lot of sympathy there. It's a little more complex than I think we have suggested. Yeah.
What is going to happen as we get toward, well, we're in the time of the end, and we have billions of dollars of institutions at stake? What kind of decisions will the leadership make when all of that is at stake?
Good question, deserves a long answer. It's going to get a short one because I will cut it in 5 minutes, and a couple other people still want to ask. As I understand it, in the book of Revelation, there'll be three great confederacies at the end of time. Confederacy of the saints will be kindred spirits from all over the world, you know, Muslim, Christian, Jewish, non-anything, all finding common cause in what God is doing in their lives at the end of time. Second group is a worldwide confederation of institutions of religion, you know, religious bodies. Third would be a worldwide collection of political powers. And in the end, the political and religious institutions try to rub out the saints. That's the scenario of Revelation. That means that institutions of religion will bind together to fight against the work of God at the end. Tragic, but what the book of Revelation portrays. As an institution of religion, what will happen to the Adventist denomination? I think there are only two options. It'll either join the Confederacy and become part of Babylon, or it'll be destroyed. And the great challenge, okay, now this is almost prophetic stuff, so I feel very inadequate to even talk about it, but it's a really good question. The prophetic stuff is, will we have the courage to look past corporate selfishness at that time? To look past it, whoa, you know, Babylon, you know, all the wealth that is lost, you see? You hear those cries out of Revelation. Will we have the fortitude of spirit, the integrity when the time comes to say we can write off all of this stuff to stay faithful to God? That will be the core question. My prayer, my mission, my work will be that we will be faithful when that time comes. But do pray for me, for the leadership, and also for yourselves, because it's not written in stone. Ellen White did say that the church will appear as if it is about to fall, but it will not fall. I take courage from that. She also said all the promises and threatenings of God are alike conditional. So you put those two statements together, and I would say it's not written in stone. So let's, we ourselves must, with God, be sure of that faithfulness. Yes? What's that? Yes, the remnant, the eschatological remnant, as I understand it, would be that worldwide confederacy of the saints, kindred spirits, probably deinstitutionalized at that point. They're meeting each other in small groups here and there, out in the wilderness, wherever. Yeah, and a great controversy has exactly that picture. So in China, through the 50s and 60s, Adventism survived, but there was no institutional cohesiveness. It was just people on their own hanging on to the faith and sharing it with their neighbors, not even knowing that there was anybody else out there. So that might be something of a model. Well, you've been awesome. Thank you for your attention, your good questions, and giving me a lot to think about. So God bless you. We'll turn it back to the pastor and draw this to a close.
Thank you. My experience as a student,
ABC, I don't know.
We as students, I think, enjoyed his candidness, very open, and humbleness.
Don't scare me with that. No, that I don't need to hear that. Okay. Well, Lord, we are challenged today. I am challenged too. As we catch a glimpse of possibilities, and of course, Lord, you have not in any way given me the full picture, and I'm probably off on half of it or more, and that's fine. But I do believe that you're beginning to catch for us a glimpse of something much bigger that you have in store, that if we don't have a focus on that, we might think that just whatever we're now doing is good enough, and it's just going to, you know, just going to work out somehow. But Lord, you know that at the core of the universe is the issue of self versus self-sacrifice, and the cross stands against pride, against self, against sin. And we waver between those, Lord. We love ourselves. We love to defend ourselves. Even when we're down on ourselves, we love to point the finger at everyone else who pushed us down. And that pride just won't give in. And Lord, I know that praying for you to deal with that is probably going to lead us into a whole lot of trouble, because that's the only way you can shake us out of this. But I pray, Lord, that you would make us willing to take whatever steps are necessary to be right with you and ready for whatever comes. I pray that you would make us willing to talk to anyone, Muslim, Jew, Christian, or secular, to talk to anyone, to learn from anyone, to be willing to recognize that you were in their lives sometimes before we were, and that working with that person may have more of a profound effect on us than on them. Pray that you'd be with us to that end. I pray that this church would be a beacon on a hill, much as it is, but spiritually as well as literally. I thank you for these people, and invite you to be at home in this place as never before, for Jesus' sake. Amen. God bless you. Good night.